from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Part one of this two-part series features Bob Chapman, the chairman and former CEO of St. Louis, Missouri-based Barry Weimiller, a $3 billion global manufacturing business with almost 12,000 team members. Chapman's experiences were the inspiration behind his 2015 Wall Street Journal bestseller, Everybody Matters, The Extraordinary Power of Caring for Your People Like Family, co-authored with Raj Sisodia. Bob's approach to business was featured in a case study by Harvard Business School. In 2013, Bob and his wife Cynthia launched a nonprofit, Chapman Foundation for Caring Communities, to bring Barry Weimiller's groundbreaking Listen Like a Leader training to communities. In 2015, the Chapman & Co. Leadership Institute was founded to bring the principles of truly human leadership to for-profit organizations through cultural transformation and leadership training. Bob and his team have been collaborating with the Gonzaga School of Business for 3 years.
Well, welcome, gentlemen. Welcome to the G Suite Podcast. Very special guest today. We have the recently retired CEO. You're chairman now, but you were CEO and you rolled off in. Okay. All right. Perfect. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong here, the manufacturing conglomerate. Maybe manufacturing is not right. You guys do a lot of things, packaging, paper, engineering, consulting,
early in manufacturing equipment and consulting services mainly.
Yeah, fantastic. And you're
globally.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and you're an author of a book.
Yes.
Yeah, and you've set up a couple different foundations, primarily focused on leadership and the right way to be a leader, not a manager, I would say.
Primarily focused around the need to share our message that we've been blessed with. Because a gentleman named Srikumar Rao came in and saw our culture, as many have, and said, I've never seen anything like this. You have to share it with the world. And you'd need to write a book. And so, again, a good business book, we're told, sells 5 to 15,000. Our book has now just topped 110,000 copies in 7 languages around the world. And the new edition coming out next week is powerful. You know, it's a 10th anniversary, 5 additional chapters. And I couldn't be more proud of. I believe it's going to be a foundational textbook in business schools on leadership.
Oh, fantastic.
The intent is to capture the conversion, how to, and the impact. That's really what it's about.
Love it. Love it. I also have with me Associate Dean and Professor of Management, Mr. Chris Stevens. And on the BW side, David Piggersgill. I'm saying that last name correct.
You are?
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. And I always joke. I've met David a few times upstairs, and I always introduce him as someone from Idaho based on his accent. So, yeah. If you ever want to go to Idaho next trip out here, we'll get you out there. So,
some people sometimes say Australia as well. It's actually near Cambridge in England.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's like Idaho in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like Idaho East. Yeah.
Exactly. I think just to say, I'm not sure that you said Bob Chapman of Barry Weimiller.
Did I skip that part? Yeah.
You said all the exciting stuff.
Yeah, and then, right. Yeah.
Bob the names. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Chris, go ahead and take it away.
Well, so Bob, for folks who aren't familiar with Barry Weimiller's journey, could you provide a little bit of background on the brief history of the company and then how it transitioned to your leadership, and then thinking, you know, in light of very recent events to Kyle's leadership?
Yeah, I think Mr. Barry and Mr. Weimiller were brother-in-laws. Mr. Weimiller was the engineer. Mr. Barry was the accountant. They started a little machine shop in St. Louis in 1885. Mr. Weimiller ended up developing a machine for the brewing industry that took them into a proprietary product and gave the company its future, building equipment for the brewing industry. Mr. Weimiller died in the mid-1915s. His wife took it over. The company kind of struggled. My dad joined Barry Weimiller in about 1950. He was with Arthur Anderson doing the audit. Mr. Weimiller offered him a job as treasurer and general manager. Company was pretty weak at the time, but my dad took the risk and joined the company. In the Mr. William Miller died of a heart attack in 57. My dad became president, ended up doing a leveraged buyout from the family because the family was tired and had no interest in the future. So our family, for an investment of $30,000, became the controlling family of a broken company. So my dad ran the company until 1975, when he died suddenly, and was able to keep it alive, but never really transform it to have a future. Mm-hmm. I joined the company in 69 from Price Waterhouse. I think I always like to say the job, I'd never considered working in Barrett Wehmiller. If you said why, I'd say, well, dad came home and told me all the problems. The Wehmillers had drinking issues, you know, the company had financial issues. I mean, I never had a conversation about it. I ended up getting an accounting degree, passing my CPA exam, getting an MBA from Michigan, getting a job at Price Waterhouse. And somebody said, you know, maybe this kid's got something.
Yeah. You know, I could sense greatness when we met on the CPA side. So, yeah. Continue, sir.
I'll never forget my dad walking down the driveway. This was a turning point to tell me as I turned in the driveway that I had passed the CPA exam on the first sitting, because it took him three sittings to pass it. When he had a son that passed it on the first sitting, that was a milestone event for my dad, changing his view of me, because he thought I was a pretty average kid up until then. So anyway, my dad approached me in February 69. He said, would you consider working for the company? Because I need somebody I can trust. So my title was somebody he could trust.
Yeah.
Okay. And the interesting thing is, when my dad and his secretary went into the office every day, the first thing they did was go to the mail room to open up all the mail to see if anybody was cheating them. Okay, that's the environment in which I started.
Right,
okay?
Right.
The beauty is, and I'd say to your listeners, the beauty is, because I started with a title, somebody he could trust, I was able to work throughout the company. I worked in engineering, I worked in manufacturing, I worked in license agreements, I worked in customer service, kind of my own self-development program. So instead of seeing just the hands of the clock, I got behind to see what gears, how the clock works.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden in 1975, when my dad suddenly dies, I'd been there 6 years. And, you know, and the first thing that happened after my dad died was the banks pulled on us.
Yeah. And you were only 30 or so at this time. Yeah.
But I had 6 years understanding how the company was working and not working. Yeah. So I had that, and I had this kind of creative mind. So when my dad passed away, I had no mentor, no board or anything. My reaction was, I ain't going down like this. And in the night, so he died 3 months into our financial year. In the full year, so I ran it for the second nine months. They had the most profitable year in its history. Mm-hmm. Why? Because I grabbed a hold of that company and I did what traditional turnaround people did. I cut costs, brought intensity, and the company started going like this. That was the good news. The bad news is I got a little overconfident because I turned it around so quickly. And I started growing it from 18 to 72 million. And I became the talk of our industry because it seemed like everything I touched turned to gold. Solar energy, electronic inspection systems for Carlsberg Brewery, filling systems for Miller Brewing Company, all these new products and technologies. And the banks loved it. The banks loved me. They said I was...
Right.
Number one client, okay? In 1983, Arthur Anderson, our auditor at the time, came to me at the end of the fiscal year and said, we've got some issues. And I said, what's that? And he said, we've got some inventory issues on your Italian inventory, and we've got some warranty issues, and it looks like you're going to lose $3.5 million. So I immediately decided to go down to our bankers and tell them, because of the relationship we had.
Sure.
I just want you aware that it's not a cash issue because we'd already started paying our debt down. Our debt had topped at 22 million. I had it down to 17 million. I said, look, I just want you to be aware of, we've got some issues in warranty and inventory, but it's not a cash issue. But it's going to result in a financial loss. They said, Bob, you know, we have a tremendous respect for you, and just make sure you understand and learn from it. Go back 2 weeks later, Arthur Anderson comes back and said, whoops, we found a few more things. It looks like it's going to be $5.5 million loss. So I go back to that same gentleman, running senior credit officer of our largest bank, and said, John, you know, and we had the conversation. I appreciate the confidence, but They now think it's going to be a $5.5 million. And he said, let me call you back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That's the last thing you want to hear.
Yeah, right. Right.
Because the next morning he said, Bob, we're pulling your line of credit. It's all over. It went from one of our favorite accounts. So the banks encouraged me to grow, said, make sure you got enough credit. But when we had an issue, right. They pulled radically on me. Mm-hmm. So I'd say to your listeners, that was a transformative event for me because I lived from October of 83 to August of 84, day to day on cash. Mm. When a check came in from a customer, we had to decide who we were going to pay and who we were not going to pay every day.
Sure.
Because avoid bankruptcy to get the material we had to ship things. And so I always say you only grow one way when you eat ice cream. When you live without cash, you learn things you never learned. Mm-hmm. When you grow with easy credit, you know, you don't learn. So I learned tremendously in that period of 9 months. And this is another thing I think our listeners would do. So at the end of 9 months, we finally got refinanced by what's called an asset-based lender. Mm-hmm. These are the people with black suits and meet you in the alley with an envelope. To financial business, it's horrible. They virtually have a noose around your neck. Right. So if you hiccup,
yep,
the mobsters of the old day, right? Yeah, nowhere else to go.
And so, but it's the only chance we had. So I went. This is a really powerful thought, and it's why I'm sitting here today. I went to our finance team. We just got refinanced. We could actually pay a few bills, even though the amount of availability of cash each week still was managed by our assets. And I said, you know, guys, I'm proud of our history, but our history does not give us a future. Mm-hmm. We need to do acquisitions to give us a future. My finance team looked at me very serious, having been through what we've been through the last year, said, Bob, couldn't agree with you more. We only have one problem. I said, what's that? And I said, Bob, we have no money. Do you understand that, Bob? We have no money. And I looked, and this is just the nature of my personality. And I looked at him and said, I didn't tell you I needed money. I told you we need to do acquisitions to get into market with better future. And I walked out of that room unencumbered by the fact that we had no money and began doing acquisitions. Okay. Attitude is so important in leadership. Okay. Mm-hmm. And also, just because we got refinanced, why would you consider doing acquisitions? Because we had no future unless we did. Okay, and so what do you buy when you have no money? You buy things nobody else wants. People will really finance you to buy their company. It's so bad. Okay, so that was in 84, the fall of 84. By the fall of 86, 2 years later, 5 or 6 acquisitions later, an idea surfaced in England where we had some operations that we could spin off our acquisitions on the London Stock Exchange, which seemed to be 1 million to 1 odds we mm-hmm. could do that. And we could pay off all of our debt, which we still were in debt, and we'd have $2 million in the bank.
So we unload the problems on the English, is what you're saying at the end of the day.
If you want to find a sucker for an investor, find them. So we'd go through all the hoops. And in May of 87, we actually thought it was going to be kind of an over-the-counter listing, not a full listing. Mm-hmm. We got on the full exchange. In May of 87, we were seeking $28 million of cash for our stock. And investors sent in $1.1 billion trying to buy our $28 million. It was oversubscribed 35 times.
Wow.
Harvard wrote a case study on it because nobody could believe you could buy these companies. Nobody wanted. Bring them together with some intensity and the market would love it.
Wow.
Okay. So, I went from not in May, in early May, I needed to borrow $5 million because our asset-based lender was at the end of his ropes. He was just tired of it. And I tried to borrow $5 million to pay him off from a bank. Nobody would touch me. So it was still that fragile. So we go public. We end up with $28 million in the bank. And 30% of a public company in England, and now our historic business, which is the really sick part, left. So I start again in 1988 with a $20 million historic business. Yeah, 30% of a British company. And this is another key point. I sat down for 9 months to think about what I had learned from all the work I did before my dad died and all the businesses, to the growth we had from 18 to 72 million, to the issues we've had to 25 million, to the acquisition we did, to the public offering. I said, what am I good at? I said, I'm good at fixing problems. And there's a lot of companies in our industry with problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to look for companies with problems. Nobody looks for companies with problems. They look for companies with good management, good markets, good future.
Mm-hmm.
So the beauty was I didn't have a lot of competition buying what I bought. But I brought this intensity that I'd experienced in the 80s fixing my business under this incredible intensity. And they started coming together beautifully. And so I said, we're going to go look for companies with problems that I know how to fix. And we're going to make sure we do it with balance. I studied a guy named Chuck Knight at Emerson Electric. He was a legendary leader in the San Luis area. He ran Emerson Electric Company,
mm-hmm.
built it from like $2 billion to $24 billion, legendary guy. And I didn't know him, I studied, but he taught the word balance. Make sure your company is not too highly dependent on any one market, any one technology, or any one customer. If something changes, you're dependent upon it. So I built a company around balance of products, markets, and technology. Our dream that I presented in probably 1990 to our board would take us from the 20 million where we were to 100 million. That business model design, which is the foundation of our responsibility as leaders, was so well conceived, it took us to 4 billion, not 100 million.
I was going
to
ask you, how'd that work out?
Our share price has gone up over 12% a year, compounded for 25 years using the EVA methodology. So, I mean, you can't, but it's kind of the road less traveled. It's a very, I'm not that smart, but I'm blessed with common sense, creativity, and a positive attitude. If you put those three together, I was able to see value where other people couldn't see it. That's why I'd say, I was able to buy companies and nobody said, we bought a company in Green Bay, Wisconsin, 188 million in sales. They just lost $23 million the year before. The banks were at their edge. They were near bankruptcy. I offered them $55 million for this equipment company in Green Bay, Wisconsin. My bankers said, oh my God, Bob, are you sure? Because by then I had a pretty solid banking relationship. I said, I know I can fix this company. Scared to death. Our board and everybody. In the first year, we made $27 million. The second year, $35 million. Got our money back in 18 months. Because I could see value where traditionally you didn't see it.
Sure.
So the company today, driven by that business model of balance, diversity of markets, technology, we've now created our revenue this year. Our orders will touch $4 billion. And we see a path to $6 billion. The world is watching this audience because it's not the old conglomerate.
Sure.
We are, we bring operational excellence, not just financial resources.
12,000 employees?
Team members.
Roughly. Team members, right. 12,000 team members.
Around the world.
Roughly, I'm trying to remember the exact number. Is it 150 organizations?
We've adopted, acquired 150 companies.
Okay, right.
And we've never sold them.
And we could talk all day just about the economics of this journey, right? But the other part of why we're having this conversation and why Barry Waymiller is a company that people talk about, an organization that people talk about, is this idea of embracing the human dimensions of the people who are part of it. Can you, I'd like to dive a little deeper into that, but I'd like to start with, because in the time you and I have spent together, I've heard you multiple times talk about this epiphany or awakening that you had about this being your job. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, your listeners, I have a traditional business background, accounting, MBA, building company around profitability, organic growth, share value. And I was a nice guy. We had a nice company. We were doing fine, even though it wasn't a straight line. It was like this. But the lens through which my education and experience taught is I saw people as functions for my success.
Mm.
Okay. There were employees, there were labor union, there were, you know, all the words we used to describe the workers. Okay. Again, I was a nice guy. We had a nice company. But I had this revelation one day. It wasn't from a book I studied. It wasn't somebody saying anything to me. It was just a revelation that took the lens through which I saw people and reversed it and said, oh my God, the 12,000 team members in the world, they're not engineers, accountants, machinists, assemblers. They're somebody's precious child that's been placed in my care. And the way I treat them will profoundly affect their well-being. So that change in the lens through which I saw people,
right,
was profound. I mean, again, when the way you look, the way you see people impacts how you treat people. Okay. And when you see people as functions, you treat them as, and you can lay them off and downsize and right size and fire them, all those broken words we use in business. But when you look at them as someone's child, you wouldn't lay off your kids, you know, you wouldn't fire your kids. And so it really calls you to a whole different way of viewing your sense of responsibility.
Sure.
Seeing people as somebody's precious child profoundly affects the way you lead your company.
And we've Everybody Matters does a great job of detailing a lot of how that translated, how that vision translated out into action. What would you say is the first thing that having that that revelation led you to change? What's the first thing you think you did differently?
Well, the first thing, because what we began is, through these revelations, is we had been blessed with a vision of the way the world was meant to be, okay, where people care for each other.
Sure.
And I had, in my lifetime, our church was very important. Episcopal Church, the rector was extremely impactful to me, and he got called to be the bishop of South Carolina, and our church fell apart. And so what if I've been blessed with this vision of what business could be in the world, a force for good, and it'd be dependent upon me? So the first thing we did is we said, we need to create disciples. So if something happens to me, this
right.
blessing we've been given will live on beyond my time.
Sure.
And so we created our own university.
Right.
And the team, this brilliant team that we had, developed these three classes we started teaching, which is listening with empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize how to let people know that they matter, and then seizing the opportunity to serve others. And now I'd say they're basic human skills
mm-hmm.
that allow us to live in society in harmony. And so the university was, and when you sat down and you said, we were just trying to convert managers into leaders, still astounds me to this day that 95% of the feedback from the people who took our classes, usually in tears,
right,
was how it changed their life.
Right.
Their marriage was better. The relationship with their kids were better. The relationship with family members was better. And I thought, what have we created here?
Sure.
And to this day, it still amazes me. Harvard's top professors, McKinsey's top leadership team come into our company and said, I've never seen anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible that a manufacturing of machinery in the Midwest, you know, we're all over the world, would be blessed with a vision of the way the world was intended to be, where people are our purpose, okay? We need an economic model to allow people to share their gifts, but our purpose is our people. And so again, it strikes me when Washington University sent in two professors, organizational development professors, to interview me a few years ago. After an hour and a half interview, they said, you're the first CEO we've ever talked to that never talked about your product. And I paused a minute and I thought, I've been talking about our product for the last hour and a half and
right.
people.
It's a-
I won't yeah. go to my grave proud of the machinery we built. I'll go to my grave proud of the people who did that. It mm-hmm. caught them completely off guard.
Mm-hmm.
So these revelations, these thinkings, this way we've tried to make sure that this message we've been blessed with doesn't die with me, that actually goes on, is turn what was a job into a calling.
Absolutely. We're at a faith-based institution. An institution that talks to our students a lot about the role of faith the role of belief, believing in yourself, believing in others, believing in a greater a calling. When you think about the intersection, and as a person who has a strong faith identity yourself, when you think about the intersection of faith and business, faith and leadership, what does that, what thoughts come to mind?
You know, given your faith-based organization, probably from a faith-based basis, you know, in the period of time I was growing dramatically, I'm feeling pretty good about myself in the late 70s. Our rector of our church was really important to me. Mm-hmm. He and I had a fabulous relationship. I actually dedicated my book to him. I walked up to him one day and said, you know, Ed, I'm not sure I believe in God. I thought that was pretty bold of me.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
To say to the rector of our church. And without a hesitation, he looked at me and said, the good news, Bob, is he believes in you. That's like, he just completely flipped around. I thought right. I was here to validate right. God. Said, no, God believes in you. And so I would say to you that my faith has allowed me to see the way he intended the world to be, where people genuinely care for each other.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you see the healing power of truly human leadership, when you listen to people around the world talk as they do to me about what it means to be an organization that cares about them, I think we're more powerful than the church of helping people live lives in faith, okay? We don't say God said for us to achieve a certain EBITDA percent. So we really believe that this calls us to a higher calling of leadership, not management.
Right.
My hope would be that the word management would die, okay? Because management, in my opinion, means the manipulation of others for your success. And leadership is a stewardship of the lives you have the privilege of leading. It's a totally different view.
Sure.
Because again, I took management classes, got a management degree, and I got a job in management. So I thought I was supposed to manage people.
Mm-hmm.
Name anybody you can manage. Name anybody that wants to be managed. We need leaders, coaches, and mentors. Mm-hmm. So the language of that, you know, why do we say in business we fire people? Do you know where that came from? A French firing squad.
Mm.
Boom, you're dead. Okay? So the language of business is broken. The practices of business are broken. So I believe God is using us to show the world the way he intended to be, where we can create human value and economic value if we have leaders who have the skills to care. I'll remind you, when Bernie Sanders was a possible presidential candidate in the United States, he talked a lot about socialism. And there were surveys that showed young people in America actually were kind of interested in this idea of socialism. And so the CEO Roundtable, America's top CEOs, came out with a full-page ad, the Wall Street Journal, and said, we need to think about more than just the shareholders, you know, Milton Friedman, shareholder supremacy.
Yeah, right.
I know some of these gentlemen, they could not be finer gentlemen. Good faith, good family members. But honestly, they have no idea how to care. They were never taught to care. They weren't promoted because they cared. So it's a beautiful statement with no ability to enact. Nothing's changed since that statement because there, you know, we see in all over our country, layoffs, downsizing, firings, you know, just the manipulation of people for financial success. And here we have the most prosperous economy in our history, which the Industrial Revolution led us to, higher healthcare, our standards of living, our education, and we have the highest level of depression, anxiety, and suicide we'd ever have. Why? Because money does not create happiness, okay? We forgot one key thing in the Industrial Revolution. We needed a human revolution integrated with the Industrial Revolution so people were our purpose, okay? When were unions formed? In the early stages of the Industrial Revolution, to protect the workers from management greed, okay? Mm-hmm. To protect them. Because we didn't create leaders. We didn't look at those people we invited to our organization as somebody's precious child. We looked at them as means for our success. So, I mean, it's just so clear to me that the Industrial Revolution forgot one key component, which is if we're going to come together in larger and larger organizations, we need people who know how to be good stewards of these people and send them home each night feeling valued. We thought it was just a pay. If I pay you fairly with good benefits,
right.
That's the exchange.
Right.
That does not create happiness.
And earlier today, you spoke about kind of the next phase, particularly in the education sphere. You want to elaborate on that a little bit? And what are your, some of your goals for higher ed and the influence of these ideas in higher ed?
Yes, as we were blessed with this message of truly human leadership and began, and we wrote the book and I began going out and speaking, I had major CEOs say to me, I thought my job was to build a market leader to create shareholder value, but it never occurred to me to care for 100,000 people. And I say, why do we have to fix adults? Why don't adults have these skills? And I look back at my education, which is a good education. I was never taught human skills. I was never taught how to care. Remember, you can't ask people in your company to start speaking Chinese or Portuguese tomorrow. You have to teach them how. You can't ask people to care. Okay? You have to teach. Care is a skill that is teachable. Okay? And so I would say to you, what I realized is our education was about getting people the academic skills to get a job in their career they want. And then, good luck. You know, boy, you got a great job. But the problem is that they then get promoted to leadership positions with no skill in being a leader. I was a good accounting manager, so we'll make you, you know, VP of finance. It's about numbers. So education, again, like the Industrial Revolution, I went back to Harvard and I said, what is the purpose of education in our country? Because I was going to give a talk at Brown University. And Harvard said, the purpose of education is to have an informed citizenry so we can have a democracy. So our founding fathers said the purpose of education was an informed citizen. But Henry Ford, another great entrepreneur in the Industrial Revolution, came along and said, I need skills. I need engineers. I need accountants. I need marketing people. Give me those skills, I'll pay them fairly, and I'll even donate to your endowment fund. I'll donate to your university. So the universities gave the market what they wanted, it's their skills, because the Industrial Revolution was creating a lot of new jobs and better paying jobs, and communities were building around it. Okay, so our universities became skills factories where we measure success by our ability to sell our product to the market, which was, are we giving the market what they want? And so I would say to you that they didn't give them what they needed. They gave them what they wanted. They wanted skills. And then those skills got promoted into leadership positions with no background on human skills and being a leader. Okay. So nobody asked for people to have good human skill, to be good stewards of people. They wanted skills to achieve financial results. And they saw people as functions. So education, again, was founded on the wrong principle of giving the market what they wanted, which were skills, not what they needed, what they wanted. And so our goal is to elevate the purpose of education, to create tomorrow's leaders who have the skills and courage to care, to go out into healthcare, to go out into the military, to go out into government, but give them these human skills combined with academic skills so we can have leaders who have the skills to care. You can't just ask people to care. Okay, you can't say, well, we're a leadership school. Well, if you have a leadership program, do you teach have people empathetic listening? No. Do you teach recognition and celebration? No. We teach ethics. And, oh, great. What's ethics when you treat people like crap? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's, to me, education is the issue we face. When you look, if Ford builds a new F-150 and they have warranty issues, society says, fix those, Ford. Well, look at the product our education's producing. Your warranty looks really bad. Education. This, the broken world.
Yeah.
These are people we...
Ripe for disruption, I see.
Yeah. And it's ready. I mean, again, what I just shared with you, nobody has ever, not at McKinsey, not at Harvard, nobody debates what I just said. They just have no idea how to change the system.
Sure.
Okay.
One of those skills that I want to talk about a little bit before we end is listening. In the half a dozen hours that you and I have been together, I would say it's probably safe to say that you've said listening at least 100 times.
No, I count 125 times.
And I think you've, in from my perspective, you've made a pretty compelling argument that listening might be the most important skill for a leader. I don't know if you share that belief, but that certainly is what I'm picking up from our conversations. Why do you think it's so important?
Well, you got to go back a step. When we decided we needed to create disciples, so it wouldn't be dependent upon Bob, we had a small team called the Empowerment Team that I went to and said, look, we need to create a university and teach these and teach skills. Well, what are we going to teach? And I said, I don't know. And so the team, we had a gentleman on the team named David Vandermolen who had a faith background. Mm-hmm. He was in, worked in church as assistant director or something, but now he's in a training program in a boat company. And David, the team came back, so we need to teach listening as a foundation for transforming managers into leaders. Why on earth do we need to teach adults to listen? We all know how to listen. I thought it was crazy. But the good news, I had a very strong team and they ignored me.
Sure.
And they developed a 3-day class on empathetic listening. Okay, fine. Maybe 6 months later, I was in Minneapolis and a young lady came up to me, probably in her early 30s, and said, Mr. Chapman, I just took your class, your university class on listening. I said, great, what was it like? I had no idea.
Yeah.
She said, it changed my life. I said, we taught something at work that changed your life? And she said, yes, I now know how to raise my 2-year-old daughter. And she showed me how what she learned there impacted the way she dealt with her 2-year-old daughter.
Right.
My senses aren't overloaded. I mean, it changed your life. You know how to raise your daughter. What have we got here? And I started traveling around the country, sitting down with people that had taken the class. I wouldn't be divorced now. My mother and I have healed our differences. And my husband and I are now talking. I was astounded that when you learn the skills of listening, not with your ears, but with your soul, it's dramatic and it's transformative. It is the healing power of listening. And I'll add this because it was amplified. So the feedback we got was nobody said, I'm running a better accounting department. Mm-hmm. Nobody said our productivity. Nobody said our engagements improve, our warranties down. Is my life has changed. And grown men and women would stand up in tears and describe what it felt like to learn to listen. I thought when you cared for somebody, you went over and talked to them. It turns out when you care for somebody, you go over to listen to them, not with judgment, not to debate, to simply validate their feelings. Okay? And when you do that, it is unbelievable how it transforms the lives of the people you touch, from your children. And so I would say to you, having done this 22 years around the world. So we actually also created a foundation outside the company because my wife went with me on one of these trips and she heard what people said after they took their class. She said, Bob, we have to take this outside the company. So we created the Chapman Foundation for Caring Communities. And I'll give you an example of listening. I live in Aspen, Colorado, in fact, 2,000 people in that valley have now taken our listening class. I was sitting in one of the graduations after the 3-day class with two police officers. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's kind of impressive that two Aspen Police Department took 3 days to take this class. And I said, what does this class mean to you? And I said, Mr. Chapman, we take hundreds and hundreds of hours to learn how to enforce the law. We are never taught how to deal with people.
Mm-hmm.
This class is the most important class I have ever taken to serve my community. I could give you 1,500 stories like that.
Sure.
From nurses who now know how to listen to the patients, to leaders who know how to listen to the team. So I would say to you, and when I go to schools, I was invited to a school because we're now working from K to 12. trying to bring these human skills into primary education, much less business schools or anything else. And I was invited to this very prominent school that's working with us very hard. And they, after a vibrant discussion with the trustees, they said, would you like to go see a class? I said, okay. And they turned out it was the debate class. So I sit down, four young men are up there debating some subject. And the teacher said, well, you know, Mr. Chapman, we'd love to have your thoughts. So I listened to these four young men. They were preparing to go to Chicago for a national debate contest. Mm-hmm. I sat there and listened to these really sharp young men debate some subject on internet security or something. At the end of it, the teacher looked at me and said, Mr. Chapman, we'd love your comments. And I said, I just saw what's wrong with the world. And they said, what? I said, yeah, these are future senators and, you know, governors, presidents, who I'm right and you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you ever listen to broadcasts of our government, I'm right and you're wrong. Inflation, abortion, all the other issues. And the issue is nobody knows how to listen. Mm-hmm. We teach people to debate. I have not been to a school yet, and I've been to many now. I said, I understand why we teach speech, so you can learn how to articulate your thoughts. I understand why you teach debate, which is critical thinking. But the most powerful of all is the ability to listen without judgment. Why don't you teach that? We don't teach that. I said, I know you don't teach it. Why don't you teach it? Nobody has an answer to that question. We just don't teach it. It is the most powerful thing we have learned in healing. So how can you be a faith-based educational institution and that give people human skills to live as God intended us to do? You know, it's just out of my imagination that as stewards of his faith, that we wouldn't give people human skills so we could treat each other as with respect and honor, regardless of whether you're, what your position, your background. So we're seeing the brokenness in this world because we haven't given people in our education system basic human skills to live in the beauty of diversity, not the conflict of diversity.
Powerful message. I think, and clearly from what you've experienced as an organization, what you've experienced as a leader, there is a formula for this. We've got to listen to each other. We've got to teach that ability. Yeah.
I would say to the SAG alumni and all of you, given the 3 years we've been having an evolving relationship, it would be massively disappointing to me if you didn't say, how are we going to bring these human skills into what we do at Gonzaga to actualize our faith, to live our faith, to bring this healing power? Because we've been blessed. This door is open for Zag to walk through. Okay. Right. It's a proven path. This is not an unknown path. We're doing it. You can sit down. You can experience the classes. How can you not do this when you've been given the opportunity to understand the impact? How could you go to church and you can ask for forgiveness, but he's going to say, get over it. These are...
You the tools. Yeah. Well, thank you for your time, for Barry Waymiller's continued commitment to Gonzaga, and we hope to live up to that expectation to create those opportunities for our students.
The world needs people to step forward and begin healing because we're going in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
The massive focus on financial wealth. Remember, we have a society, I'll leave you with thought, we have a society where success is defined as money, power, and position. Doesn't matter how you get it, as long as you get it legally. And then you can write checks to charity and we'll say you're a wonderful person. We didn't ask you how you got your money. We didn't ask you how you treated people. We just took your check. We need charities in this world to heal the brokenness we're creating. Okay? So the greatest act of charity for the leaders, the alumni of Zag, is not the checks you write to Zag or other great institutions. It's how you treat the people you have the privilege of being. That is the greatest act of charity.
Well said. Appreciate you. Appreciate you joining us today. We're actually going to continue because with David, I think you have other appointments to get
he's
on much, to.
He's a man of faith, so you're going to get a lot of good stuff from David.
All right. Perfect.
See,
perfect. Yeah. Yeah.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. Your hosts were Chris Stevens and Andrew Brassage. Edited by yours truly, Stuart Herringer.